Welcome back. We didn't go anywhere. We just had a little Fats Domino in between. Blueberry Hill, magic voice from the past. Reminding you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you, and money comes back in the end. More information, www.mecu.com, or you can go to steinershow.org, click on their banner, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. So last night, I was texted about the death of Chakwe Lumumba. Carla Willis, who works here, texted me saying, did you hear about the Chakwe? And we were all really shocked to hear that he passed away yesterday, the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi. Chakwe Lumumba was a very special human being, especially think about where he became elected mayor, what city he was elected in. And we had been in touch with his office just a few weeks ago about arranging an interview with him when we go to Mississippi with one of our guests here, John Wesley, to finish our documentary on Fannie Lou. And we're going to do what was going to be Fannie Lou to Chakwe Lumumba and this political look at that state and our country. And then the real news, Paul Jay and I texted back and forth last night. He was supposed to interview Chakwe today for the Real News Network. They canceled an interview on them 2 days ago, saying they would reschedule it. And then Chakwe passed away. We're not sure why. But Chakwe Lumumba was a person who was the vice president of the Republic of New Africa back in the 60s and the 70s. He was a man who described himself, really, when he said, what are you as mayor of Jackson? He called himself a revolutionary. Didn't call himself a liberal. Didn't call himself a conservative. He said, I'm a revolutionary and a pragmatic revolutionary. And we'll talk a bit about him in the first part of this program before we helped us use that platform to launch into a conversation about not just Trayvon Martin, the anniversary of his death today, but also all that's built around it. When we did our day in history, I told you the story of Wyatt Outlaw, North Carolina, Reconstruction politician, Civil War hero, who was lynched as head of the first police chief of his town who was black and stood up to the Klan. And there's a history here, but it's deeper than it's race, but it's more than race. And we want to get into all of that, but talking about where we can go with all of this. We're joined once again by our all-star panel. Kay Whitehead is with us, Dr. Carsonia Whitehead. Kay Whitehead is Assistant Professor of Communication and Affiliate Assistant Professor of African and African-American Studies at Loyola University, Maryland. Good to see you once again, Kay.
Thank you so much.
John Milton Wesley, who knew Chakwe and Mississippi-born, and I'd like to say the godson of Fannie Lou Hamer, who's working with us on this documentary project, author, songwriter, and senior fellow in the social marketing with the National Center for Health Behavioral Change here at Morgan State University. Edward Wyckoff Williams, one of my new, not so new anymore, favorite writers, contributing editor at The Root, political contributor and special correspondent with Al Jazeera, a columnist and political analyst, appearing on MSNBC, ABC, CBS Washington, and nationally syndicated radio. Michelle Antoinette's with us, known here in town as Love the Poet, indie spoken word artist and musician who does national performances and literary art scenes, author of Black Marks on White Paper, an active member of the Speakers Bureau for Poetry and People, and Lenny McAllister, Republican strategist, former congressional candidate. You can see his work at LennyMcAllister.com, and welcome all of you. Good to have you all with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to be
Thank
with
you,
you
very
Mark.
Much.
Great
Good
to be here.
410-319. 88, write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Tweet me at Mark Steiner. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Log into the Facebook page, which I'll take a look at in a moment. 410-319-8888. John, let me just start with you. Because you, just reflecting for a moment, those of you who want to, I know that not everybody really knew much about Chakwe Lumumba.
Yeah.
The name, because how many people get elected mayor of a city whose name is Chakwe Lumumba?
Chakwe Lumumba.
And
happened
to Kwai Siamfumi when he was elected from Baltimore. What's your name? Right?
So I mean, so. Right.
But in all seriousness, Chakwe was a very powerful figure, an important figure.
Yeah.
as a Mississippian and someone who knew him, let you begin the quick reflection here.
Well, my first reflections go back to the meetings that we had when Choco was vice president of the Republic of New Africa. I was a reporter for WLBT-TV in Jackson, Mississippi. And when I first went to Boston in 70, the Republic of New Africa was very much into their campaign to set up a separate state. They had applied to the United Nations for charter, and Chokwe was the spokesperson. So I got to meet him then, and then, of course, later on, they were raided as part of one of the COINTELPRO operations, and everybody who was in the home of their headquarters there in Jackson, which was one street over from where I lived, were charged with murder. And Chokwe, fortunately, because he lived in Jackson, he was not in the house that night. But there had just been a national meeting in Milwaukee, and all of the national officers happened to be in Jackson on the night that the building was raided. So everybody in the house was charged with murder. A friend of Chokwe's, Wayne James, who was the Secretary of State for the Republic of New Africa, his wife actually stayed in my home during the trial. And Chokwe, imagine going from being one of the most hated people in Jackson to becoming the mayor of Jackson. I mean, that's quite extraordinary. And given the fact that he used Fannie Lou Hamer's formula, you know, the Maryland Freedom Democratic, Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, the Maryland, Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party actually did these kind of practice elections across the state. They had a big convention and nominees and delegates. Chokwe used that same process in Jackson to actually set up these town meetings that went on across the city. And nobody really thought that he would be able to do that. But in essence, the people of Jackson gave Chokwe to the political apparatus there. And that was how he became mayor of Jackson.
Mm-hmm. I actually met Brother Lumumba twice, once when I was an undergraduate at Lincoln University, and a number of us were protesting against what was happening in Virginia when they wanted to cancel spring break because African Americans were meeting in Virginia, so they decided to close the town. You could not come back and have spring break. So we met with Stokely Carmichael, and Brother Lumumba came. Yeah. And I remember he told us, and this is over 20 years ago, but he said that, you know, it's a strange privilege to go to college, and that having this opportunity, you have to do more, you have to be more, you have to be the ones that we have been waiting for. I met him again when I was a graduate student. I was studying as a Woodrow Wilson Fellow with Barbara Jordan out in Texas. I met him and I told him, you told me when I was an undergraduate to do more. He said, then show me what you've done with your time. Have you done more? And I've always been challenged because I follow the work with Assata Shakur.
Right.
I follow him throughout history. I've been
He
was her attorney. Right. Assata Shakur, right. Of course.
He was Tupac's attorney, too.
Yes, right. He was Tupac's attorney. Right. You would talk about Geronimo Pratt. I mean, we can just go back through history.
Yeah.
But this idea that he embraced this term radical. He said it's radical to force America to live up to its highest ideals. That's the kind of radical that I want to be, to just force America to be better than what it is. So I think highly of him.
Even though he had a revolutionary principles, he saw himself as a pragmatic
revolutionary.
Exactly. He became mayor and he said, okay, I'll go along with the state of Mississippi to do it your way so we can get this infrastructure money to start putting people together. But what he did was he just started including the people of Jackson in his councils, his people's councils, to decide how the work should be done and ensuring that the poor people of Jackson, 80% of whom are black, got work. And so, I mean, he was putting principles to work and he was really – you know, that he was very serious about that. And he, of course, had liver cancer and beat it. But they said he died of heart failure. We don't know really what happened.
Exactly
but
happened.
But he came roaring back in fortune, whatever he did, and took
and
him pretty suddenly.
Mark, I think if you look at the race for mayor, it was just so traditional Mississippi. You know, when Amzi Moore first invited Bob Moses to come to Mississippi and start the Freedom Project, that was in 61. Well, you know, Bob got ready to come, and Amzi said, maybe you need to wait a while. You know, because the established, organized NAACPs, those organizations, SCLC, I mean, the reason that SNCC was formed was because actually they felt that they were a little bit too radical for SCLC.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that Chokwe would come into Jackson, do what he did, and then challenge the traditional candidates and win. I mean, if you look at Harvey Johnson, you know, as a traditional...
Right, the former mayor.
Exactly, right. Who was also black. But, you know, when you look at what Chokwe was able to do, and then he surprised a lot of people because though he did consider himself a revolutionary, he was a pragmatist, and a lot of the people who disagreed with him most, those are the people who he gave positions of power in government once he became mayor.
One, just very quickly, a lawyer who won election for his, when Lumumba ran for city council and won, then became mayor, a younger man who took his seat and was also a friend of the family said, during the campaign they raised all this hay about his being a radical. Aside from wearing dashikis in the neighborhood, he was just a loving father. I just saw him as Mr. Lumumba from up the block.
Right. So, right. Right.
And Mark, it sounds like this, despite his reputation as a radical, he was actually quite diplomatic.
Oh,
even
right.
Just following
Absolutely.
Up with what was just said, the fact that he brought on people who formerly had been adversaries, at least from a policy or perspective, to bring them in and at each other just goes to show that he was so much bigger than caricatures of him.
But this idea of radical is not a negative term. I
want
to be clear
that
as he took on this term radical, this idea of forcing America to be better, we tend to see radical as being something negative.
Right.
He took it on and redefined that term. Radical is something we should live up to. Anyone that forces this country to be better is considered to be radical.
Yeah.
He worked within the system to bring changes, raising taxes to make the place better. I mean, that's radical when you think about it.
And it's actually, like, to speak to that point, it's actually quite amazing. I'm sitting here thinking, and of course, I've heard of Chokwe, but I've never dove into his life, and to sit here, I'm having kind of like a history lesson live and in living color. I'm sitting here like if I could be Indian style, I'd be like sitting here with my hands under my chin, and to see the bright looks on you guys' faces as you speak about your experience with him it definitely speaks to the fact that the idea of radicalism is something that can uplift people.
Well,
before we move to the next part of our conversation, I just want to say that one of the things that it reminded me of, because I told the story of Wyatt Outlaw earlier, who was lynched in 1870 as part of Reconstruction, is in that sense, there's a direct lineage for me between the freed men, they were men,
right.
Even the women weren't part of the leadership too, the freed men who were elected, were part of the leadership in Reconstruction, post-Civil War, when everybody in America was going, oh no, if black people get positions, they're going to kill all the white people.
Right.
Because they enslaved, we were all enslaved all these years,
exactly.
So they could come back and rise up and kill all the white people.
Right.
But the exact opposite happened when an open democracy was formed in those states where Reconstruction flourished. And Chokwe did just what Edward Wycliffe Williams said, which was that the majority of white people in that community did not support him, and the vast majority, but he brought them into the administration to start working on economic development and other issues because he wanted an inclusive community to bring everybody up and move ahead. So that's
Give you a visual.
And then we have to...
Okay, but a quick visual. Keep in mind, the Republic of New Africa stood in front of their headquarters with their rifles and their guns.
Right.
Okay? Okay? We got to understand this. Okay? And to go from, in Jackson, Mississippi, standing in front of your building with your guns out and your black berets and your leather jackets, to go from that to be mayor of the city of Jackson... That's pretty interesting stuff.
His loss is tragic, and I hope that whatever happens in the wake of his death continues what he was trying to build.
His work.
Because throughout the South, the urban areas are like the oasis of change, which is what he was about as mayor of Jackson, Mississippi. So our hearts go out to the people of Jackson, Mississippi, and, of course, to his family and everyone else.
Yeah.
We lost a great American, a great human being.
Yeah. Yes, a young man, too.
Did.
Only 66 years old.
66 years old.
So let's continue this conversation because I think this is the first anniversary of the death of Trayvon Martin, and we've seen the trials that took place in Florida since, and the other instances that have taken place, and people wrestling with this stuff. And I read a piece this morning about that the role the prosecutors can play. Well, I'll get to that later. But that we are. This has kind of raised an issue in America that America's wrestling with. And I'm just curious from all your perspectives, What does this mean beyond? We know what we mean about it. We've covered all the time institutional racism on the show and what that means in America. And I think we're clear about that. We can talk a bit about that, but we talked about that a lot. Mm-hmm. I'm really curious to talk about what you all think as activists, as writers, as journalists, as artists. What do we take from this? What do you build? Mm-hmm. I mean, as an activist, as a former organizer myself, what do you do around this to make the change? How do you begin to America to heal, not just to heal, because it's sometimes easier to heal than it is to grow. Right. You know, but you can't grow without either one together. So what do we think? I mean, where does this take us?
I think, if I may, I think we're in a situation where America is okay with continually ripping off the scab, if that makes sense. Let me speak from the perspective of like pop culture and what is going on with George Zimmerman currently. You know, I've seen things wherein he is selling paintings and has become a quote unquote artist in his own right, thus glorifying the things that happened with him and becoming somewhat of a figure in the community, in a pop culture community. And the whole idea of him, the fight between him and DMX that was supposed to happen, I found it very interesting. They called it off, but they only called it off because Damon Feldman, the person organizing it, the promoter, received numerous threats and had to get a bodyguard. It wasn't because, and he initially was like, I don't want to do it because he's not a celebrity, but it became a cash cow, you know, and it was something that people were getting excited about and wanted to see happen. And I feel like that is continually ripping the scab off of a wound that we're trying to figure out a way to stitch. And we're not going to be able to if the people, the likes of George Zimmerman, continue to be catapulted into the public eye as somebody who should be glorified.
Well, I'm going to come back to that thought in a second, what you just said. Let me go first to Lenny McAllister. Lenny, you haven't opened your mouth yet, which is odd, so let me get you in here.
I think when we look at race in America, we look at the Trayvon Martin situation 2 years later, we look at what happened with the Michael Dunn trial, and I'm Jordan Davis. I know that we're sitting here in Pennsylvania, and in March we're going to be looking at Jordan Miles and Darren Manning, the cases in Pittsburgh and Pennsylvania, respectively.
Oh, right.
We are looking at a situation. We're both young men, honor roll students. They're charged with criminal acts against police, and you know the police so far have been able to get away with not having any criminal charges filed against them. In fact, the Jordan Miles case is a civil trial, not a criminal trial. I think what we have to look at is how do we vote. How much are we involved civically so that the laws that impact our lives on a regular basis reflect the diversity and the respect for diversity that we need in 21st century America? I think that we also understand that without economic power, true economic power, we have a harder time pulling the levers of politics. We have a harder time having our voice heard because we have unfortunately stood on the sidelines long enough to allow money to speak louder than citizenship, and we have to reverse that dynamic. Money cannot mean more than citizenship in America when it comes to justice, when it comes to equality, when it comes to civil protections, and that's something that the Trayvon Martin situation and the aftermath of that should be highlighting to us because we're going in the wrong direction in many, many of these instances. Mm-hmm.
Edward?
Well, you know, I've been looking at this lens of what the president is announcing tomorrow.
Right.
My Brother's Keeper's initiative, which is focused on young men of color, specifically high dropout rates in high school, trying to figure out ways to address the issues in education, but also the criminal justice system. And he's modeling, I think his intention is to take the Becoming a Man initiative, which is out of Chicago, and sort of represent the country. And the success of that has shown graduation rates increase from 10% to 23%, violent crime arrests reduced by 44%. So the Becoming a Man initiative has achieved some success. But the problem that the president faces, so one of the things I thought was really interesting that Lenny just said is it makes us think. So this whole situation requires the community to think about who we elect. Well, we've elected the first African-American president, and these things are still occurring. Why? Because even in this, even with that power and that platform and that office, his ability to affect this kind of change remains very limited, partly because there's so much pushback from Congress, right? But also because these problems are so deeply entrenched institutionally. So even when you look at the type of strides that Eric Holder has tried to make by bringing down the ratio of crack cocaine to powder cocaine, it's still not equal. It's still, there's still a wide gap there. And we're talking about something that's now been in place for 30 years. And so economic empowerment, education, lack of opportunity, these things are so much bigger than Trayvon, right? But he's sort of emblematic of why of why that all occurs. Like, all these stories are part of the broader narrative around the violence against black bodies and around the disenfranchisement of black people. And so I think a part of what, you know, you asked, well, what do you guys think about this as a writer? I mean, there's so many issues I want to attack here that I never know where to begin. And I feel a little disappointed in a way, even though I'm excited that the president is bringing to bear this initiative and talking about these things and opening up this conversation. But like you and I corresponded, there's no funding for this. And how far can he really go trying to address some of these issues without funding?
We're going to have a very brief break and come right back. And I have want to clear some things. I said 1 year. It's been 2 years since Trayvon Martin was murdered. And I have my producer sent in the original tweet from the cancellation of the Zimmerman fight. I want to read that when I come back to you, get a sense of what's really going on. We'll be right back. Please join us at 410-319-8888. We went out with Sinead O'Connor's cover of Prince's Nothing Compares to You, which was the number one song on this day in 1990. And we are coming back with Johnny Cash again. I Walked the Line.
I Walked the Line.
I Walked the Line.
I like that.
He was born on this day in 1932. And we are here with Dr. Kay Whitehead, Assistant Professor of Communication, Affiliate Assistant Professor of African and African-American Studies at Loyola University of Maryland, John Milton Wesley, author, songwriter, grew up in Mississippi. Edward Wyckoff Williams, contributing editor to The Root, political contributor and special correspondent for Al Jazeera, and a columnist and political analyst on many media. Love the Poet, who is a spoken word artist, musician, author of Black Marks on White Paper, Lenny McAllister, Republican strategist, former congressional candidate, and you can see his work at LennyMcAllister.com and hear his voice here on The Mark Steiner Show. 410-319-8888 is number. I'll check Facebook in a minute. What I said as I was going to break, the fight promoter did cancel the event through Twitter. Then a few days later, he said, it's back on. He wrote, I sent those tweets because I went through an emotional situation. I looked at my kids and I got emotional. I didn't sleep for 3 days because I'm trying to figure out how the thing happened. As of right now, the fight is not canceled. Right now, we're in meetings as we talk. It all happened so fast. It became a worldwide story. I honestly don't know it would go so far as the White House and me being threatened. Zimmerman still wants to fight.
I'd like to add to something that you said earlier, as I sit here stunned with the comments you just made, when you talked about what do we do with what happened with Trayvon? Where do we go from here? You said as writers, as activists. I add to that as academics, and even more importantly as parents. And I think of us as communal parents, because we're raising, you know, all of these children together. When the Trayvon Martin incident happened, I argue that it was something of a wake-up call. For middle-class black America, that this idea that you can't work hard enough or make enough money or send your kids to the right schools and they're fencing and they're swimming to move up out of this perceived criminality around black males.
Yeah.
I get very concerned about that. As I mentioned over the break, I moderated President Obama's Black History Month panel on Monday, and we were at the White House, and we focused on African-Americans in the armed services. And we sat there watching this documentary where you had Black Tuskegee Airmen and World War I vets and World War II vets telling stories about how they would go and fight against the enemies against democracy abroad and then come home and have to get on the bus, pay, and get off and get on the back of the bus, but that they kept moving forward. We've forgotten about that. I think as we have moved up and our jobs have gotten better and our pay have gotten higher, we've forgotten that there is a history that runs through this country around the issues of race and class that must be dealt with. So with Trayvon Martin and this memory of Trayvon Martin, what can we do to help our young sons understand some of the triggers? As I tell my son, it's not about the hoodie. It's not about playing the music too loud. What are these triggers that are happening within our community as a whole, where now when you confront someone, particularly young Black males, you're expecting them to acquiesce, mm-hmm. to give ground, to bow down, to move out the way because you're telling them to do so. I published an op-ed about Michael, the Dunn case last week, and I received death threats. I was told that I am what is wrong with America. I am a race baiter because I accuse this country of not moving past this war of trying to keep Black males safe. So if we can't even have an open and free discussion, mm-hmm. then perhaps we still are not at a point to move past
it. Let me push a little bit further. Something I said before that I've gotten some pushback on, I'll say again.
Not surprised.
I look at the, and this is really going beyond Democrat or Republican, but to me. But I look at the broad body of America that elected Barack Obama.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And as I look at it more, it has less to do with Democrats or Republicans or Barack Obama.
Right.
Than
right.
it does with a huge body of people in America trying to think a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at stories about what happened in America with that a lot of struggles we've had in America have always been divided on race. Labor union movements, left-wing movements, mm-hmm. other people's civil rights movements have been divided often on race in this country in our history. You start a history where if you had less than 1% of the people in America really thought or cared enough to be active abolitionists to want to end slavery of right. white people in America, right?
Right.
But here we have a huge minority – I'll let you jump in this first, Edward. A huge minority of white Americans who voted for Barack Obama, mm-hmm. along with huge majorities of people of color, and more women than men of all races, mm-hmm. and young people, and the majority of young white people mm-hmm. who voted for Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm.
So this. The building of a consciousness is that taking place. We had DJ Spooky on the show yesterday. And Paul said, we talked about this whole idea of remix. And I was positing a theory that the 21st century is a remix century. Where cultures, where the exploitation of Black culture that took place, there's something else is happening also under the undercurrent, which is that there is a remaking of American culture. There's a remix going on. So what do we do with all that? Maybe you don't agree with that, Edward, but let me put that out there.
Well, where was he going with the remix? That somehow in a backlash kind of way?
No, we're having a remix where there's a redefinition of America that's coming out from all sources, that Black America.
I completely agree, and I think that that's a...
Say it again. You broke up, man. Say it again.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're breaking up a little bit.
Okay, hold on. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, we got you. Go ahead.
Okay, good. I completely agree with him about the remix theory, and I think that that's exactly what's happening. This is America's really becoming the melting pot that we first started talking about in the 80s and early 90s, right? There's also this backlash, and that backlash is real, and there's a conversation being had in circles of power about how...
Say again. I'm sorry, everybody. It must be where you're standing with your cell phone.
Can you hear me?
You're really, really breaking up.
Mark, can you hear me now?
Yes, we got you.
Okay. To get to the point is, I think that, yes, we have these deeply entrenched ideas around Black males being violent and all that. That comes out of a long history here in this country, right? And so the remix that's happening is changing the way that we view ourselves. But then, from a policy perspective, not much is changing. And unless we actually have policy changing, mm-hmm. we're not going mm-hmm. to see that change on a social level.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good point. And I'll let him go first.
Great, let it go ahead.
Here's the thing about the policy changing. You have to look at voting patterns. You have to look at economic patterns. You have to look at how we approach education, how we approach civics overall. And when it comes to redefining ourselves, we haven't redefined any of those things over the last 50 to 70 years. So if we're doing education the same way, and we believe that the vast majority of our political capital should be behind public education exclusively, and the vast majority of our political capital should be behind one political party, and the vast majority of our political capital should be on getting jobs versus creating jobs, and our mindset is the same exact way over the last 50 to 70 years, and the geopolitics, the geoeconomics have all changed around us, then it's no wonder that some of the obstacles that we have are self-inflicted. Now, not all of them. I'm not going to sit there and say that this justifies an armed grown man following a 17-year-old armed with Skittles and iced tea, or a grown man that's probably buzzing to go grab a gun and shoot into a car just because he's upset about some music. I'm not saying that. But what I am saying, the reaction that we have as a people, that we have as Americans, cannot be along the lines of the same things we've done 70 years ago and wonder why it doesn't work in 2014. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to just follow up, too, because, and I want to bring this right here into Baltimore when we talk about policy. One of the things that has been proposed by the mayor to deal with issues in the city, especially with young youth, black youth, youth in general, is to have these 24-hour community service centers. In other words, they're going to be open all night.
Right.
My contention is that, first of all, that's a great idea. But what do we do with it? Okay, what do we do with it? Well, you know, one of the things that we can do with them is that we need action steps, Mark. We need to create something that allows every young person who participates in these things at night to, you know, be off the streets during the curfew to actually create a product. You know, what they're going to do with the time. If we don't come up with action steps that result in them actually leaving the place better than they were when they found it,
right,
then all we will have is a warehousing, overnight warehousing place for young people. So it's important that we have these community centers open at night, but it's also important that there be something for young people to do that's a project. It can be a song. Go on.
Well, I was just going to say that let me come back to where we are here in terms of what, as a larger society, we can do. I would just say that we had a conversation the other day about this a little bit, and these aren't community centers. This is a place where they're going to pick up kids who are busting for curfew and bring them
and hold them there,
and
right?
It's a holding cell.
We can use the word community center.
I'm trying to reframe it, Mark. Yeah. Okay.
But that's part of a bigger issue. We're talking about picking up kids who are busting curfew, taking them to these, quote, community centers, and then, as you said, the doctor here, perhaps giving them projects to work on. I think we are in the midst of trying to push toward a better conversation. I think we need to get into the schools to have young boys and girls begin to see themselves doing something differently, because right now that is not happening. We're still going down the same path. I know there's a lot of pushback with saying, well, it's not just, you know, white men armed with guns who are shooting black boys. Yeah. We know there's a lot of black on black crime. That still doesn't negate the fact that this happened and it shouldn't have happened. So the question is, how do we deal with this increased violence inside and outside of our community?
Well, if I can chime in on that a little bit, I thought about that fact that, of course, it's not just white men with guns going in. Black on black crime is happening and has been happening. And as a black woman, one of the things that I have just put my foot down on is I'm just tired of my babies dying.
Right.
Like, we need to look at it from that kind of standpoint. Like, what can we do to stop people from killing our children, not just white people, black people, whomever, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And to speak on the concept of remix, you know, I was a teenager in the 90s, so I know a little bit about a remix. Mm-hmm. And that was the time of the remix. And a remix, essentially, at its core, is taking an original song and changing it and building on it and making it better. But what makes a good remix is when you can still get the feeling of the original song and the original concept, and it comes across better, bigger, maybe even gives you another perspective on the angle of the piece. Now, at this point, I feel like America is on the path to a very bad remix. Mm-hmm. I don't think that our remix is, because we're not staying true to original concepts of what, like, how to be better. You know, I feel like we're just throwing a whole lot of things in a pot, and the internet and all these things are making everyone, and I said this about the 50th anniversary as well. When I went there, it was about 60, 70 people talking about something different. Everybody was talking about something
exactly.
different. What are we going to come together on to make this thing cohesive?
And is a part of that a lack of leadership
yes.
on these issues?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Because it seems like, I love how she articulated that in terms of the 50th anniversary march, because people really were all over the place. And even as
exactly.
I was producing content for Al Jazeera to mm-hmm. cover it, I realized that there was a cohesive idea around what the issues we should be talking about were. And so I think that a part of the dilemma of having the first African-American president is he literally has to lead a nation globally and so is addressing so many different issues that it becomes very difficult to address only the issues of African-Americans, right? And but then in light of that, there's almost leadership is existing in a certain kind of vacuum where there are a lot of voices, but there's no air. And I feel like that's a part of what's happening here.
And so where does that take us, Edward?
I think it takes us back to grassroots, and I think it's why I think you wanted to talk about Mr. Lumumba, not just because obviously he passed away, but his work shows that really the way to affect change is from the grassroots level. A part mm-hmm. of why Barack Obama's My Brother's Keeper's initiative is a public-private partnership is not just because Congress would not give it funding even if he tried, but also because he, as an original community organizer, realizes the way to affect change is at the local level. And you have to build upon that and then take that nationally. And so I think that we need voices, Mark, and the people around this panel. We need activists out there seeking for cities to raise money for to create.
But I do think that there are some...
Most of our young people are dealing with.
I'm sorry. I do think there's a little bit of air that's taking place. I mean, I think about the March on Washington, the anniversary as well. But at the same time, you have 50 to 60 or almost 70 people down on the mall talking and talking. They did take 300 African-American children up to the Senate, and we had a separate March on Washington there. I was actually one of the speakers, and we were having these 300 kids from all over the country come together and make this active decision to choose the pencil over the penitentiary, asking them to make choices, to make a declaration, to write a statement. So grassroots activity is happening. It may not be happening on the mall, but it was definitely happening with these 300 kids in the Senate. And I think that's one of the ways that we can make changes. Maybe it's child by child, community center, real community centers, not, you know, holding cells, but community center by community center, getting these young people to begin to think about themselves differently. Because it's not just, you know, older blacks and whites who are killing young blacks. It's us killing ourselves.
Yeah.
It's young people actually participating in these acts of violence. How can we get them to make a decision to do something else?
Okay, and I think there's one other piece, too, that we really have to be very clear about. And I saw an example of it yesterday. I stopped at the 7-Eleven to get a son, and it was about school closing time. And I realized that all of these young black males were standing outside of the store. Well, I was thinking to myself, so why are they standing outside? Because there is a fear of a gathering of young black men.
Mm-hmm.
So they are not allowed in the store yep. at the same time.
Right.
Okay.
Wow.
I mean, now that, and I'm sitting there and I'm looking at it and I'm not thinking, I understand pilferage. Understand. But my question was, what must they feel? You know, what must they feel that they cannot go in there, that there's a fear of them being around? And I think the other thing to keep in mind, too, if we look at this case of Dunn, I thought it was very interesting. If you look at the book by Stephen Whitfield, A Death in the Delta, one of the points that he makes is that the feminist movement could not start until white females convinced their husbands and brothers to stop killing black men under the guise of protecting them. Now, I thought it was very interesting that part of Dunn's reasoning for doing the volley of shots was that he feared that his girlfriend would be injured when she walked out of the store. I thought, now, wait a minute. Am I hearing some echoes back to the Till case in this? Yeah. The only difference is that where he assumed, Don, he assumed that he was operating within a climate of consent. What did George Zimmerman assume? That he was operating within a climate of consent. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that must be dealt with is this climate of consent of which these actions come.
Yes.
Absolutely. So,
Lenny, you about to say something?
I agree with what we're saying here. I also think that we have to make sure that we understand that when it comes to, we're going back to private-public partnerships, that we have to understand that it still goes back to a level of investment that allows for self-sufficiency. I think that when you're able to chart more of your own individual path, you're at a point of time where you can have the freedom and the stability to stand up against the structure. I think that because we don't have a unified enemy, if you will, such as a Jim Crow or such as the aftermath of slavery, in light of that, you must have a certain type of stability that allows for the dynamic of Black America, the dynamic of urban America, the dynamic of Generation X and millennials to stand up in a diversified body to push back on some of these things that are out there. That's only going to come when you have a certain level of educational and economic stability. When that comes about, then you can push back on some of these things in a way that's appropriate for the 21st century. Right now, what I fear is that we continue to take outdated models of protest, outdated models of analysis, and apply them to 2014 and wonder why we still get regressive results.
I actually agree with Lenny, and I want to make a point. A part of what he said about not having a unified enemy, I think is very true. A point was made on Melissa Harris Perry's show by somebody who works with Color Lines. I can't remember. But she basically said that there is this, she was talking about Bloomberg and how Bloomberg had put $100 million behind an initiative for young men of color here in New York City. And he was doing that while still defending the racially biased program of Stop and Frisk. And so you often have people in America, and I think the system works this way, sadly, that there's this spoken desire to assist young Black people, young Black males in particular, and to sort of get at the root of some of these structural malaise in our country. But yet there's also this real commitment to the status quo. And I think that until we can break that barrier, we're still going to be having this conversation. Mm-hmm.
And it's a barrier we've been trying to break for years. Yeah. That is not a new barrier. And we do keep coming up with solutions. But I'm still hopeful. I mean, I think we're still working out this great experiment here in America called democracy, called faith, called freedom, called equality, called justice. And I think we're still trying, even though we may try to apply old models to these new situations. It's the idea that we are still trying. We're still having these conversations and we're still trying to come up with a solution. My argument is it's not one solution. We need a series of solutions to deal with the multitude of problems that are not just facing our community, but facing all low-income communities in this country.
Yeah, and I think I definitely agree with that. And I think to speak back on what you said, John, about the climate of consent, I had this thought the other day about how it seems now that these laws are created or have been created just so that people can find the loopholes in them. And that's where I feel like we are, because the climate of consent is like, okay, I'm going to go out here and do this. And not that he consciously thought that, but that's just the feeling, just the learned behavior. And in it, I'm sure it was like, you know what? There will be a way for me to justify this. And it seems like laws have been created and people now are at a point where it's like, hey, let's just find the loophole in it and call it a day.
It seems to me that one of the things, though, that this is in America and might be a point to pick up on next conversation, it's a question of power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And who has power. I mean, we had, it made me think, we had a, the other day we had a conversation on the show here where it was about Baltimore. And Jeff Singer had this statistic, which is a pretty stunning statistic. We have 191,000 families in Baltimore. Families.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Households. 86,000 of those households in this city are not sure they can pay their rent.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Right. Are worried they could lose where they live, that they cannot keep up with it month to month. 86,000 of 190,000 families are home insecure.
Right.
Mm-hmm. In a city. So you've got people underemployed.
Mm-hmm.
And we always talk about teenage employment and getting kids to work, and we talk about black-on-black crime. But one of the things that kind of dampens that is adult work.
Right. Right.
If adults have work, then they have kids they can take care of.
Yes.
And families can remain whole where they live. So, I mean, it's a question of power and who controls not just a conversation and a dialogue, but who controls what decisions are made about how you're going to run society.
And people cannot think rationally about that if their basic needs are not met.
Right.
And that's what you're speaking about right now.
But here it goes back to a common enemy. And we talked about this on the Pittsburgh Cable News Channel last Friday. We did a show on Night Talk, Get to the Point, where I hosted. And we were talking about Black History Month. And are we more focused on celebration or focusing on the crisis within the Black community overall? And one of the points that we brought up is the fact that because we don't view ourselves the same way as a cohesive community, we'll do it when it comes to reelecting President Obama or getting him in there in 2008, or when it comes to the Tea Party, so racist. But
when it, and
those type of memes, if you will. But when it comes to the actuality of will we reinvest into the Black community, will the Black middle class make sure that there is home security, food security, job security in neighborhoods that two generations ago or even just a generation ago or perhaps even 5 years ago, some of the Black middle class moved away from and elevated themselves up the socioeconomic ladder. We have an obligation in the 21st century to those that were hit over the head with batons, those that were bitten by dogs, those that were lynched, castrated, raped, etc., to make sure that we are investing ourselves, our lives, our dollars, our time back into those communities. That's how that's going to be solidified. There's not that much policy that you can put into place that's going to solve poverty if we don't invest ourselves, because no one's going to take us seriously, number one. And number two, at some point in time, self-interest, when you deal with human beings, is always going to come back into the fold, and that doesn't care about skin color at all.
We have to actually end here at this point, but I would make a posit here, maybe pick up again as the next point of conversation with some of the people in this panel and others, is that is it just a question of a Black community taking care of the Black community? I'm going to posit something that will end here. People can write emails and say you disagree. Go on Facebook and agree. That I think is beyond that.
I think so.
I think there's no way in the world the Black community is going to take care of the Black community to lift it up out of its economic plight.
Everyone has to participate.
If it's not a universal American thing together, it's not happening.
Right.
Not at all.
No single group can do it on its own in this country.
No, absolutely not.
That does not happen until we coalesce, though. And that's the thing. And the same thing happened in the 50s when there was a level of coalescing around issues and a movement can transpire. Then you can impact American society.
Yes.
You can get international support.
Yes.
But you have to be able to coalesce and bring about a level of solidarity within the diversity and within disagreement.
And we have to remember the Civil Rights Movement was an interracial movement.
It was an interracial. Right. Everybody was involved.
And I have to say this.
We have to wrap up. You have like 10 seconds, girl.
Sadly, I feel like we're kind of a day late and a dollar short on that. I feel like we're way too far gone at this point to figure out how to get back to the point where we should have been in the beginning at integration.
But I think that's hope, though.
But that's the
we need hope,
but
definitely.
But that's the remix.
that's the remix.
that we can get back.
That's the remix.
That we can get back.
So I'm going to thank you all. Edward Wyckoff-Williams, always good to have you with us, brother. Thank you so much.
Thank you, brother.
Kay Whitehead, great to have you in the studio
once
again. Congratulations on being at the White House during your peaks.
Thank you.
John Milton Wesley, always great to have your sage wisdom on our program here.
Thank
Lenny McAllister, always great to have you part of the show as well.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
And Love the Poet, good to have you in the studio.
Always glad to be here.
We'll take a very brief break, and when we come back from this break, we are going to meet Angel Christie Williams, who's been on the show before. She's a young filmmaker who made this film called Christmas Tree that we talked about last time, and now she's coming back to Baltimore to do a new film about two young Black girls in the inner city and their struggle at friendship and more. We're going to talk about her work and what she's trying to do. Stay with us. We'll be right back.